And here we are, back in the studios again. We're going through the COVID setup blues right now. My brother is manipulating microphones and headphones because we've got a full house here.
This is unusual, but it's fantastic.
Yes, it is. We're up to our eyeballs and guests this morning, which is a wonderful thing to have.
We're going to have them introduce each other.
Please do.
I'm Taras Lysenko.
Okay.
From A&T Recovery.
Nice.
Here with the F4F Wildcat
An
Fighter.
Actual F4F.
Yeah. Bureau number 12260.
Okay. Because we're all familiar with, I mean, the F4Fs we've seen were not F4Fs.
They were FM2s.
FM2s. So.
They were the General Motors built.
I'm Conrad Hostetler with Wild Warbirds. A Wildcat rebuilder. And just to add to your comment, there's probably 12 or 13 Wildcats still out there, and all of them are FM2s except for this one.
Wow.
So this one's kind of a
rare. A super rare bird, yeah. And lastly, way over there?
Yes, I'm Steve Craig, and I was privileged to be able to own and fly this plane for a number of years, almost 10, I guess, and then tribute to our veterans and various venues, including Oshkosh in 2004 and 2008, I believe, and then Rod Lewis acquired it from me.
Okay. So tell us about this particular airplane. When was it built?
Oh, you're going to ask us exact questions on when it was built?
Well, I know it's Monday. I know it's
something,
tough.
Something
well,
like 1940.
I can answer that. I believe it was built in early 43, mid 43, in a group of, I think, 20 Wildcats as F4F-3s.
And, okay.
So the F4F-3, just to talk about the different variants, this one's special because it is a Grumman-built Wildcat. All the FM2s were built by General Motors. So when Grumman started building the Hellcat, they pushed the production of the Wildcat to General Motors. So all the Wildcats we see, the FM2s, are typically not built by Grumman. So that's what makes this one special, is it is the last airworthy, true Grumman-built Wildcat.
How many did Grumman build?
I think they built something north of 5,000 Wildcats during the war.
I think Grumman built approximately F4F-3s and -4s about 1,960, and then General Motors took over and built another 5,000. I think the total production of Wildcats was around 7,000, but that's close, but not.
Now, did they continue building those after the Hellcat came on the scene?
Yes, they did.
Okay, even though that was like totally outclassed.
Well, the Marines in particular liked it for the and the Navy for the escort class carriers, you know, and there were a lot of escort class carriers built, you know, for the island campaign.
Okay.
But what really makes this Wildcat cool, it was at the bottom of Lake Michigan for about 50 years.
Wow.
Now that raises a question.
That's a difficult parking lot.
What kind of condition was the airplane in when you finally pulled her out of the water?
Oh,
wet.
They just washed it off, brushed it off, and started changing the
put
oil.
Put a set of jumper cables on it?
Put some duct tape on the broken wing and took off.
There you go. And it only took them, how many years to get that fixed?
I don't know. It would take them 4 or 5 years to restore it.
Well, it came off the bottom of the lake in 1991. Taras was the guy that did it. And Dick Hansen and Jim Porter acquired it. And I saw it the first time at Oshkosh in 1994 when Bill Dodds, noted test pilot for Warbirds, taxied in with it. And I was there with my 10-year-old son, and I was amazed to see this artifact coming in.
When you take something out of a lake that's been there for 50 years, that doesn't sound much. It doesn't sound like a restoration as a complete reproduction. I mean, how much of it was left?
Oh no, it was there. It was all there.
One of the beauties of Grumman aircraft is they're completely anodized. So every part on it, every aluminum part on it, is anodized, and every steel part is CAD plated or protected somehow, as well as a couple layers of paint. So these Grumman airplanes actually stand up really well underneath the water.
So corrosion wasn't that big an issue.
Wasn't that bad, the magnesium?
It was in certain areas.
Certain areas, the magnesium, because the anode, the aircraft on the bottom becomes a battery, so there's electrical charge, so you have electrolysis, and so the anode slave first is the magnesium. But no big deal. Conrad's flying it around, right? So it's...
Well, obviously, but I mean, there's always the question of how much of it did you actually end up replacing?
Well, we didn't restore it, so the other guys did. Well, but a lot of, 90% actually.
Yeah, 90 or more percent of the airplane is original.
Wow.
Well, I can address that a little bit. Dick Hansen did much of the work, and then after I acquired it and flew it a few times, I did some more work through friends of mine in California. Pete Regina and others, Matt Jackson helped a lot, and Dick was is a wonderful guy and was tremendous to work with, and so... But the center section is steel, and that was redone. The right wing was damaged by the Wolverine when it ran over. That was completely rebuilt by Nelson Ezel. So it had the right people doing the work.
Well, how much of the airplane did you actually take apart when you first got this thing? Were you actually drilling rivets out and taking wing skins and fuselage skins off to look at the inner structure?
Now, I can't say I did that. I can say Dick Hansen and Nick Quint at Blackhawk did much of the work when that preceded Bill Dodds flying it in here in 1994. And then I continued with certain issues relating to the fuel tanks, the electrical system, the trim system. The plane was out of trim. I flew it the first few times, and it was way out of the stabilizer, and the elevators weren't set correctly. So that was interesting. But it was basically in fine condition. Yeah.
So for all those pilots out there who want to find out about flying it, so Steve flew this for almost 10 years, but Conrad has flown both F4F-3 and FMs. So if you want to get it, come see it, get some really detailed pilot from talking to these two guys.
Okay. Yeah, well, I'm wondering, do you get insulted when they call it an FM2?
Well, I was actually insulted on the way up here. I went to the self-serve, and someone called it a T-28.
Oh, God,
that
wow.
Is an insult.
Yeah, well, it's a little different.
See, now my response would have been, yeah, it was made by Cessna.
Yeah.
and then you would have seen on the internet, oh, Cessna made T-28s.
Nice. No, T-28s have 6 engines.
Right, exactly.
Really? Well, maybe.
I thought they had 4.5.
Well, on a good day.
Yeah.
So the level of rebuild, as you asked earlier, is really dependent on how the airplane's damaged and how much corrosion there is. And because it's all anodized, the fuselage on this airplane was mostly intact, and it's pretty neat to see. They didn't derivet and disassemble the entire fuselage because it was in such good condition. So the paint on the inside of the fuselage is still the factory paint.
Oh my.
It wasn't repainted, it was simply cleaned.
And of course, my recovery operation was perfect.
Oh, yeah.
And we didn't damage anything. That scratch on the little lifting axis.
That
was intentional. I had a mark with a
nice, nice. How did you I've heard there's lots of airplanes at the bottom of that lake, but they still can't be that easy to find.
It's why there's only one team in the whole universe that could ever do it. That's us.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
How many airplanes were down there?
There was they lost about 130, and they had a recovery operation. We estimate they recovered about 10 to 15. If they lost them in 50 feet of water, the crash boat could throw a buoy, and the divers could find them. Much deeper than that, in those days, it would get pitch black and so they didn't have sonars and stuff, but the shallow ones they were able to recover. So like people look in the records and see that there were 4 Hellcats that crashed in the lake. 3 of them were recovered. They 2 Vindicators, 1 was recovered. So go ahead.
Well, the thing is, when you recover a Navy airplane, does the Navy still lay claim to it?
In this case, no. But
but that's because we made a deal. The Navy, I relate it to if you're going into Walmart and you drop your wallet and 5 minutes later I come along and I find it. It's my wallet, right? No.
Yeah.
Well, the $1,000 you had, and it's going to be mine. But no. Anyway, it's your wallet. In Western culture, we reward people who return our property to us. In the marine world, it's called admiralty. It goes way back hundreds of years. It dealt with ships, vessels in distress. So you find a vessel in distress, the owner rewards you for finding it and helping them. This applies basically to this. The Navy lost it. It's theirs. In this case, to get these Wildcats in an SBD, we did a bunch of work for the Navy, and they used a little-known thing in law, Title 10, United States Code, Section 2572, which is actually the law that allows a VFW hall to have a tank out in front of it. It's all in that law. It's how the military can historically promote so the public sees the military. So it's covered in there, and it allows for exchange of items. So the Congress allocates money for the Department of Defense to fight wars, it doesn't really allocate much money for the Department of Defense to promote its history. Because that's not really their business. Their business is to continue to fight wars. So it has this law of exchange, so that's what we used. We did a contract for the Navy, got them a rigid, what do you call it, rigid wing or static wing? What do you call it? I don't know how, I always call it a rigid wing. And what they did to pay us was they let us have several aircraft on the bottom of Lake Michigan. So we recovered it, and it's a good thing there's guys like Steve and Conrad that know what to do with them when we recover something like that and turn it over to the civilian world.
We got to go to break. This is Digital Dave.
And I'm Fast Eddie.
And this is EAA Radio.